This is November 13th in the year 2000, and this is Bob Gilgore interviewing R.D. Smith at his home at 200 Caldwell Street in Chapel Hill. Good morning, R.D.
Good morning.
I'd like to begin with just a broad question about when you were born and what it was like growing up in Goldsboro.
Well, I was born in Baltimore, Maryland. My mother, of course, was an RN, basically. And she was in Maryland at that time. And she later moved back home, which is in Goldsboro, when I was quite a baby. I was born February 21st, 1918, in Baltimore, and moved from there back to my grandfather's home, which was my mother's home, in Goldsboro, North Carolina, about 5 miles outside of Goldsboro, on my grandfather's farm. And of course, being a rural person, we went to a one-room rural school. And one of my jobs was to, since the teachers lived with my grandfather to a great extent, the teacher, I assisted her in making fires in the old wood stove every day. 5 days a week, so that we could stay warm.
So the teacher was almost part of your family.
Well, she really was. She really was, and of course, that put a damp on some of the things that you could do with the teacher. You dare not actually act up in school, because the teacher would come home and tell your grandparents or your mother. My mother was away from home a lot because of being a nurse, and of course, there's one reason why I was staying with my grandparents. And I stayed out in the rural school until I was in sixth grade, and then we moved into town, and went to school at the elementary school and the high school in Goldsboro. Graduated from the high school, Dillard High School, in 1935.
So did your grandparents raise you pretty much?
Primarily they did, because my mother and my father separated when I was a baby, and that's when my mother came back home. And being a nurse, private duty nurse primarily, most of her life was spent in private duty nursing with nursing people who either were sick, is definitely ill off and had babies. And she was working in connection with a local doctor there in Goldsboro.
Did your grandparents work, or were they?
No, my grandparents were farmers. Man, my grandfather had a farm. Raised cotton, tobacco, corn, sweet potatoes, and vegetables, and all of that kind of things that hogs and chickens, you know, just whatever they needed on the farm for survival. Whether they didn't can, they froze them, didn't freeze them, but they, you know, it's a funny thing. My parents used to take butter and put it down in the well, which was real cold. And it would stay down there until they needed it. They'd pull it up with a bucket.
So you were a farmer too, I guess. You ended up working on the farm?
Oh, yes. Sure. I ended up working on the farm. And then when I went to college, I took a course in vocational agriculture so that I could come back and assist farmers in making a living on the farm. That's why I came to Chapel Hill. I came to Chapel Hill as vocational agriculture teacher. I graduated from Hampton University, Hampton Institute at that time, with a BS degree in agriculture. And I came here as a teacher of vocational agriculture.
I assume that you lived in a segregated area in Goldsboro?
Yes, primarily, yeah, it was, because back in those days, most of the areas were segregated. I mean, there was a section in which the Afro-Americans lived and a section in which white people lived. So it was segregated. Schools were segregated. In fact, everything was segregated to a great extent. You know, you could go in stores and buy stuff, but that's about it, because, you know, people didn't mind selling your stuff in their stores. But that was the extent of it. Very few, some Afro-Americans worked in some stores as laborers, of course, you know, not as salesmen, but they worked as laborers, doing the muscular work.
What other kinds of jobs did the black community hold besides men had jobs as laborers?
Then most of them were laborers. They had a box factory in Goldsboro, and they had another factory that made water meters. Water meters that you see out on the streets all over the United States. A lot of them were made right there in Goldsboro. And of course, that was a place of employment. There was a factory that made boxes that were shipped all over the world, and that was the major source of employment for Afro-Americans. Other than the farms, you know, a lot of them worked out on the farms, the seasonal primary.
Did you have any extended family around you growing up in Goldsboro? Aunts, uncles, cousins?
Oh yes, sure. I had my aunts lived in Goldsboro. I had two aunts, and three uncles, and all of them were right out there on the farm. With their father, which was my grandfather, and we all grew up together.
So it's like community farming with the whole family working?
Oh yes, everybody who lives in that household did some work on the farm, even my grandmother.
Was that a happy time for you?
It was a very happy time for us. So we were a very close-knit group of people, and as I said, we grew most of the food that we needed to eat, so nobody ever went hungry. There was never a day in which any member went hungry. There was always plenty of food available, and it was available because of the cooperation between members of the family in getting that food in order in which it would be preserved or carried over from month to month. The chickens and the eggs and the hogs and the turkeys and the vegetables and sweet potatoes, well, we used to hill sweet potatoes. They don't do that anymore like now. We hill sweet potatoes. We take sweet potatoes and put them in a pile, and on top of that pile, we'd put pine straw. Cover them up with pine straw. And then on top of that pine straw, we'd put dirt. And when you want a sweet potato in the wintertime, you go out and dig through that dirt into the pine straw and pull out a sweet potato and then close that hole right back up. And those sweet potatoes would last all winter long because that was just enough of storage. So, you know, it'd be amazing now if people had to do what we had to do back then.
So, when you finished with your grammar school, you moved into town?
Well, I moved into town at when I was in the sixth grade, which was before going to high school. Because then you only went to high school in ninth grade, ninth, tenth, and 11th grade. So we had three years. High school, didn't have 12th grade. 9th, 10th, and 11th. You graduated when you were in 11th grade.
How big a school did you go to?
Well, I guess still it was about 350, 400 students. Because everybody, every Arab American went to Dillon, along with youngsters who lived in the county. That was the high school. They come into Dillard High School, which was the primary high school for Afro-Americans in that area, in Wayne County.
How would you compare the black high school with the high school that you worked at in Chapel Hill that was integrated?
Well, from a standpoint of teacher-student relationship, there was a great deal of good relationship between the students and the teachers. One of the things I think that stood out was the fact that the teachers cared. The teachers were concerned about the students' progress to the point that they made sure that students were learning something. They made sure that the students were motivated to the point where they could learn. They felt comfortable. They felt a great deal of pride within their school. That's one of the things I think that, to a great extent, the integration, to a great extent, eliminated from the standpoint of the Afro-American student. They didn't, to my knowledge, there wasn't that pride in school. Once schools were integrated, that, like it was before, when we were at all black school, Lincoln had a reputation of excellence in a large number of areas, band, football, basketball, academics, and those type of things, because the students felt that somebody cared about them. The teachers cared, the principal cared, and they were close together, and the parents cared. The parents and the teachers and the principal all went to church together, and they prayed together, and they did a lot of things together.
They lived in the same neighborhood.
They lived in the same neighborhood, and every teacher lived in this community, right close to the school. They lived with parents to a great extent. Those who teachers who did not have homes here, they lived with some of the parents. When I came here as a teacher, I lived with a family right up here on Church Street. Mr. and Mrs. Ernest Thompson, I'll never forget them. And they took me in, and we had meals there with them. We did a lot of things that would build a good relationship between the teacher and the parent, the family that we were living with.
So you knew all the kids?
I knew every
all the families.
That's the advantage that I had over when the integration started. That's the advantage that I had over the white teachers. I knew, and a lot of the parents, I had talked prior to the integration. See, I started teaching here in 1942. And of course, integration started in 1966, primarily. So that, I had advantage of a lot of people, a lot of other teachers, when the high school was open. Because I taught a lot of the parents, I knew the kids, almost every parent in this community at that time I was familiar with. And all I had to do was call a mother, or call a father, and say, your son is doing this and that and the other. And most of the children didn't want me to call their parents. And that was one of the students whose picture we have in here. His mother and I were real close.
I wanted to go back to growing up to get an idea of what the neighborhood was like in Goldsboro, where you lived when you moved into town, whether you had paved streets, whether you had running water, whether you had plumbing.
We had all of that. We were living. I moved into town with an aunt of mine, and she was within 3 blocks of the center of Goldsboro at that time. So we were. I mean, the neighborhood was a nice, quiet, well-established neighborhood. We had the only doctor in town at that time lived next door, Dr. Gordon. We had mail carriers who were Afro-Americans in the city at that time. They lived close by. Dr. Whittington, Hatches, and all of those people. The Undertaker was within 1 block. The druggist was in half a block of us. I used to work at the drugstore after school for a long time. And I ended up, my last few years, working with the Undertaker as a part-time job after school, trying to get ready to go to college.
So you didn't go back out to the farm?
No, we didn't go back out to the farm. I mean, just for visits, yeah. I'd go out and visit my grandparents quite often. In the summertime, after school, I'd go to my grandfather's. I'd go to see grandpa and grandma, you know, help them on the farm.
Did you feel poor?
Never felt poor. No way to word. You know, as such. You know, people used to think you're poor because you didn't have food to eat, you didn't have clothes to wear, you didn't have the necessities of life. I never felt that way. I had clothes to wear, I had plenty of food to eat, never went hungry a day in my life, you know. And I enjoyed being out there with my grandparents, and they enjoyed having me out there, you know. So, you know, there's a certain division that you live within, a certain area. And you found happiness within that area, you know, with the people who live there, the other students who live there, the grown people who live there. Because back then, you know, you say it takes a community to raise a child. But believe me, if you did anything in that community, if one parent knew about it, your parents knew about it. Because they would discipline you just like you, because they'd tell right away. Now, I know Lula doesn't know that, what you're doing. Lula was my mother's name. That was the whole community helped raise the children.
You had a very close community.
Oh, yeah. Sure. Yeah. Very close community.
What about the interaction with the white community? Was there much interaction there?
Only from the standpoint of I would say, the fact that a lot of the people, a lot of the Afro-American people work for white individuals. And of course, the relationship to a great extent was good between them. You know, interaction was good between the adults. Of course, the children didn't have that much interaction other than the fact that, you know, you go to the store and you buy a piece of candy or something like that, you know, soda, that type of thing. That was the extent, mostly, of the interaction between the students and the white adults. Of course, there wasn't that much interaction between the students and students because they lived in different sections. So when I'd come home, in the black community. And very seldom was there any... See, like nowadays, you know, there's integration all over town. A lot of your close friends are white kids. A lot of their close friends are black kids. That type of relationship didn't exist because nobody thought about it. We were happy with them within our area, with our friends. It's a great step, and, you know, people didn't want to be associated.
When you graduated from high school, you went on to Hampton. Was that considered a typical kind of thing in that school, that a high percentage of the students would go on to college?
Not necessarily. It wasn't necessarily that. It just so happened that my principal, Hugh Victor Brown, an excellent guy from Kentucky, was a Hampton graduate. And if you showed any promise whatsoever, Hampton was the place, the only place for you to go. And he made sure that you got admitted to Hampton. He had that much relationship with the Hampton itself. And he sent a large number of students to Hampton. If you wanted to go to college, you went. But you went to Hampton. And of course, a lot of them went to Durham, the North Carolina College for Negroes in Durham, because there were teachers on the faculty who graduated from those colleges. See, my mother graduated from St. Augustine Nursing School. And the relationship between alumni and the graduates, to a great extent, determined you go to college. My parents didn't have money enough to send me to college, but Mr. Brown made sure that back in those days, you would go to college and take a work year, what we call a work year. You go to college, you work the first year. And then you took two classes at night, math and English, at night. But you worked the other time for a year. And after that, you always could have a job making 25 cents an hour. 25 cents an hour, and usually somewhere on that campus. Now, I took a work year in the kitchen at Hampton, my first year. And I worked the other 4 years in the kitchen. During lunchtime, during mealtime, I'd come in at breakfast, I'd come in at lunch, I'd come in at dinner, and work serving the waiters who took the food from the kitchen to the dining room. So it was a family-style type of thing. we'd put food in a bowl, and there'd be enough in that bowl for the 8 people who were at that table, or 6 people who were at that table. And I worked in the kitchen for 25 cents an hour my whole college career. I worked in the kitchen. Of course, as an agriculture student, I find time to work on the farm. See, we had a vegetable farm, we had a poultry farm, we had a dairy farm. The dairy farm, of course, was located right now where Langley Air Force Base is in Hampton. We had to go through the air base to get to the dairy farm. And then when the expansion of the dairy farm took, I mean, the Air Force Base, our base, took effect, the Army or the Air Force bought the farm. And we moved that farm into town, right across the street from Phoenix High School, right down the street from Hampton University. And that is the farm that, when I graduated from Hampton in 1940, I was hired by the school to manage that dairy farm for 2 years. I was manager of the dairy farm that they moved into. And then after that, I came to the chapel. But there was always jobs available for students who wanted to work. And a lot of students, because of their financial situation, had to work, had to find some time to work. See, my parents, my mother was not, even though she was a registered nurse, she wasn't able to send me to school because my tuition at Hampton was about $300 and some a year. And I worked at 25 cents an hour to pay that tuition. And worked in the summer. But I was determined to get an education. It was just that. The principal of my school, my teachers, expected me. My parents expected me, even though they were not financially able. But they expected me to take advantage of every opportunity that I had to get an education.
Did you feel that your high school prepared you well for the education you got?
Very well. Very well. I have no regrets whatsoever. I had excellent teachers in high school. I had teachers who expected you to excel. I'll give you an example. I had a math teacher. Never forget it. Jerry Hatcher. Excellent math teacher. And she gave me, back in those days, she marked 1, 2, 3, 4. Not A, B, C, D. 1, 2, 3, 4. She gave me a 4. The only 4 I made in my whole high school career. And I asked her, Miss Hatcher, why did you give me a 4? Can you imagine what she told me? She said, because you are not working up to your ability. And that was a motivator. From that day on, I understood what she meant. That's just the type of, that's what the teachers expected of you. To work up to your ability. And they used every method that they could use to be sure that you worked up to your ability.
Of your graduating class, how many would you say went on to higher education?
Well, my graduating class was about 30 people. I'd say a third of them went on from higher education.
The stories that I hear about the facilities at the black high schools were that they had old books, they had old things that the school people had used them before at the white schools. Was it that way in Goldsboro?
Well,
also?
To some extent, but it really didn't matter. Those books, those same books had the same material in them that every other student had. Because there may be a different edition, but basically, the information in those books was the same, and the teachers used not only those books, but other means, educational material, to make up for what those books might not have, or what they felt you ought to know in order to qualify yourself for college. That was more or less the attitude. They realized, take what you have and make the best use of it. And that's what we did. That's what they did.
Did you find that same sort of thing in college, or did you have supplies?
Oh, good. We had everything we wanted in Hampton. There was nothing like that. Hampton provided whatever you needed or whatever the teacher needed for your education experience. You know, a lot of times the teachers would use their own money in high school and elementary school to buy additional supplies. We did that here in Chapel Hill when I first came here. Teachers spent a lot of money buying, adding new material, a different material to the textbook, because we used textbooks that were handed down from the high school or from wherever we could get them. But as I said, we didn't have, the school system didn't furnish everything that the child needed. They only, and the parents raised money. The first activity bus that we had at Lincoln, the parents raised the money for $2,600 and bought that bus from Raleigh. The parents did that. The school system didn't get activity buses. Nowadays, they're furnished activity buses, you know.
So you were the head of the dairy farm at Hampton for 2 years after?
Well, I was 2 years after I graduated. The agriculture department began a program. They would select one graduate to operate, give them the experience in farm operation for a year. Now, I started in December, and I went through that year, and then they said, well, we don't have a student now for the next year. So I stayed on for the second year. At the end of the second year, they hired Edward Bowling, I forget, a local boy who grew up right there in Hampton, almost. They hired him to operate the farm. Well, that was an understanding. I had an understanding that would be one of them. So I went to the placement office and asked them. I said, you know, I'm going to need a job. They said, yep. And the placement office and I were real good friends. So she called me one day and said, I got three jobs you can take, three requests for ag teachers. One, of course, was somewhere in Georgia. The second one was in Eastern Shore of Cape Charles, Virginia. And the third one was in Chapel Hill. So I talked, they had a supervisor of all farms, one man, Mr. Bonjan, who was from Kansas City, yeah. So I talked to him. He was nice, real nice guy, real close to his working. I said, Mr. Bonjan, I got three chances for jobs. And he, of course, knew I was leaving. I said, I got a chance for a job in Georgia. I got a chance for a job in Eastern Shore, Virginia. And I got a chance for a job in North Carolina. He looked at me and he said, I'm a white man. I wouldn't go to Georgia. So that took that one out right then. That's the words he said. That took it out right then. Forget it. Well, being from North Carolina, and we had a lecture series in Hampton, and we would invite different people in to lecture, give a lecture. Of course, everybody had to attend the lecture. And the college invited Charles Jones, who was a minister, a Presbyterian minister, to come to Hampton and speak to the student body.
He was a white?
Yeah.
Presbyterian?
White Presbyterian minister, right. The Jones House out in Carver is named in his honor. That time, Reverend Jones so impressed me, along with other students at Hampton, because of his idea and attitude toward the race issue. But I said to myself, I said, you know, I think I would like to work at Chapel Hill. Because he was way before his time, way before, ahead of, ideas way ahead of other people, other white people. And when I came here, he was the first, his church members were the first members. They invited me to their church, all white church, down on Purifor. Because that's when the church had split up, Freshman Church here, and they had established a church on Purifor River.
He left the church over on Franklin Street.
Yep. I have no idea about it, but all I know is they had evidently, he was too liberal. It was evidently so. And he, along with some of his members, established a church on Purifor Road.
That wasn't the Church of Reconciliation.
No. It was the Church of Reconciliation down on by the mall.
Yeah.
What's the name of the church down there?
It's not the community church.
Yeah, the Community Church of Chaplains. Yeah, that's the one. They actually established that church. And he was one of the members of that church was the first members, along with Reverend Jones, who invited me as an Afro-American to attend their services when I came here in 1942.
How did you deal with that?
Well, it just re-emphasized to me what he had said at Hampton.
He was walking.
That's right. He wasn't just talking. He was carrying out what he had said. You know. So, I felt good. I felt good because I was received, you know, by members. They didn't look at me from a standpoint of color. They looked at me as a, more or less, I guess, as a human being. As an Afro-American who evidently they thought maybe I was some type of special person, you know. I was the first ag teacher in Chapel Hill, you know. That type of thing. They didn't have an ag teacher until I came in.
So you got the job of the agricultural teacher at Lincoln High School in 1942.
Well, it was Orange County Training School then, the school right over here. See, the Orange County Training School was the all-black high school in 1942, which was a Rosenwald school.
Can you explain that? I'm not familiar.
Well, the Rosenwald family began to establish what they call training schools for Afro-Americans throughout the country, in the South particularly.
Rosenwald?
Yeah. And this was one of them that they established, the Orange County Training School. Now, people looked at it because they thought it was some type of school for delinquents. Because a large number of black schools, I'd say, were training schools. They were named training schools when they were established. And everybody from grade 1 to 10 to 11 went to that school. All Afro-American students in Chapel Hill went to that school, along with some from the county, just because the school system included a large, this end of the county, until they had a referendum, and it more or less separated the districts, the Chapel Hill School District and Hillsborough School. And a large number of the schools who used to come to Chapel Hill then had to be transported to Hillsborough. And they were originally, because their parents did not agree to paying an extra fee for the kids, an extra tax, I'd say, for their children to come to Chapel Hill. So since the county's responsibility for providing school for all children, those kids had to go by bus.
So did you have to pay extra to go to Rosenwald School?
No, that wasn't Rosenwald School. That was after Lincoln was built.
Or the Orange County Training School?
No, you didn't have to pay anything. It wasn't any tax at all other than your county tax, you know, your tax, property tax.
Was that supported by county taxes?
Oh, yeah.
Supported by the road?
No, no, by county taxes. Orange County Training School was supported by the state and by county taxes. Teachers were paid by the state. So I don't know, for a long time, we had, in the winter in particular, we had bad weather. And back in those days, teachers had to teach, work 20 days before they got paid. And we'd go to school sometime 2 days this week and 3 days next week because of snow. Until you worked 20 days, you didn't get paid. So we had to appeal to the school board. Listen, we need some money. So they then initiated a procedure in which they would pay teachers the 20th of every month, regardless of the number of days they worked. The 20th of every month, you got your pay. Because it was a hardship, really, in the wintertime to get 20 days in. Because everybody, a lot of the kids, students who were at Orange County Training School, were bused in. And those buses couldn't run because of snow or bad weather. We didn't have school.
When did the Orange County Training School become Lincoln High School?
When did Lincoln High School flood? Gosh, I don't even remember the date. I guess it was back in somewhere in the 50s, I guess. My wife might be able to tell us when that happened. But that might be a research thing for you to look into, because I don't remember really.
So they were physically in different places.
What's that?
The Orange County Training School, yeah. Lincoln High School.
Oh yeah, Lincoln High School was where the superintendent's office is now. Mm-hmm. When that building was built,
right.
The students moved from over here, Orange County Training School, into that school, and Orange County Training School then was converted into an elementary school, which was North Side Elementary. In 1966, when Lincoln, when the integration took place, Lincoln then was converted into an all sixth grade school for all students, black and white, who lived in Chapel Hill.
Now, when you moved to this area, did you move to the North Side?
Oh yeah, I moved right around the corner here, right up on the hill on Church Street. And a big house up there, like Church and MacD.
Were all these streets paved at that time?
No, the streets here. When I moved over here, this was a dirt street.
Did they have plumbing?
Oh yeah, they had plumbing.
So did they have baths and showers in all the houses?
Yeah, no, not all the houses. Not every house had it.
So but some had outhouses?
Yeah, when it started the government program and home rehabilitation, then the town made sure, and the town committed itself to pave every street in the Afro-American neighborhood.
Was that under Howard Lee?
Under Howard Lee.
So that was 69?
Yeah.
So it wasn't until 69 that the streets in the black section of Chapel Hill.
With all the streets.
With all the streets.
So this street was paved before 69, but we had to give, I think, 3 feet of our property in here. So that they could pave the streets and put in sewer.
And the outhouses and those things, did they disappear at that same time too?
Well, over a period of 3 years, because they put in sewer and water in every street in this neighborhood.
So there was no water in some of those
well,
streets?
As far as I know, there might have been a few, not many, that needed to hook onto water. But there wasn't sewer in all of them, because before they paved the street, they had to put in water lines and sewer lines wherever they needed to make sure that those utilities were underground before they paved the street. Because they didn't want to come back and have to tear up the street to put it in.
You came here in 42, and now I know you're married.
when did you get married?
I got married June 1943.
Local girl?
No, young lady. We were dating each other in college in Hampton. She was from Newport News, Virginia. But I told my principal, who then, which was Mr. Harold M. Holmes, who was principal of Orange County Training School. I said, "Mr. Holmes, I'm going to get married this summer. And I'm marrying a young lady who is a first grade teacher." At that time, she was teaching in South Carolina, a little place called Fountain Inn, South Carolina, right out of Greenville, about 19 miles out of Greenville. I said, "And if you need a first grade teacher, I would appreciate you considering her." He told me, he said, "Send in an application." So I sent in an application. She sent in an application. And she was hired as a first grade teacher before we married. So when we married June 19th, went on a honeymoon and came back here, and she had a job. She knew she had a job in Chapel Hill before we got married. And she was hired as a first grade teacher at Orange County Training School.
How long did she teach?
She taught her. Well, she was in the school system 38 years, same as me, same as I was. She went from first grade to maybe second grade to fourth grade to seventh grade, and she ended up as a guidance counselor at Culper Junior High School. And she retired in 1941. I retired in 1940.
She retired when?
1981. I retired in 1980. Yeah, right.
Can you tell me about your days as a teacher at Lincoln High School? What your average day was like?
Well, first of all, let me say this. When I came to Chapel Hill, I came to Chapel Hill with one, what I would call, basic philosophy. And that philosophy was, because of my teachers in high school and what they did for me, and the fact that they made a difference, I came here with that same philosophy. I'm going to make a difference in the lives of the young people that I teach. And I have, for 38 years, that has been my philosophy. I am going to, even when I was assistant principal at the high school, in Chapel Hill High School, I was determined that I would make a difference in the lives of the young people that I had contact with. When the principal asked me to become his assistant, I told him, Larry Graham, I said, "Larry, well, first of all," he said, "if you don't accept it, I'd have to go outside the school system." I said, "That would be terrible, right during the integration process. Bring somebody in new who didn't know anything about the kids. The kids didn't know." I said, "On two conditions, I will become your assistant. First condition is that we will listen to the students. We don't have to agree with them, but listen to them." I said, "They'll tell us something. And secondly, if a child comes to your door, or to my door, I don't care who's in that office with us, we take time to see what they want." I said, "Because it takes a lot of nerve for a youngster to come to the principal's office. And if we turn them away, they're not coming back. Because they at that time, the youngsters, particularly Afro-American students, had a belief that nobody cared, particularly white teachers and the white administration."
That's didn't. after the school opened.
Yeah, that nobody cared. Now, I said, "I don't want that to happen." I said, "That can't happen as long as I'm assistant principal of this high school. It cannot happen." One of the corrections that I have there, in some way in that first draft I got, said something about mascots. Now, during the summer of 1966, and that's the other change. During the summer of 1966, they had a committee of students, black and white, who met, and they decided what the school colors would be, what the mascot would be, and everything. So what they did, they took, say, Lincoln High School was Tigers. Chapel Hill High School was, what was that? In other words, they took the mascot of Lincoln, which is Tigers, and the colors of black and gold, or gold, from the high school. They decided on that. So that was never in question. The students made it, they decided what the mascot would be at Chapel Hill High School and what the colors would be at Chapel Hill High School. Teachers, students, superintendent, nobody had anything to do with it. They let them make that decision, because what was happening throughout this country in integration, that was an area of contention, a tremendous area of contention, because usually when they integrated school, they took the color and the mascot of the white high school.
So you had some pre-planning here before.
Oh yes, sure. As far as the colors, the mascot, and that type of thing was concerned.
What about the school song?
I don't even think they have it. I don't know whether they even got a school song now, and I'll tell you the truth.
Uh-huh. And the trophies?
Well, the trophies, that's another question. See, Lincoln, let's talk about the trophies later.
Yeah, let's go. I mean, I definitely want to talk about this,
yeah.
But I wanted to go back to your days at Lincoln High School. And then I didn't realize that you were an assistant principal or vice principal. But
at high school.
At the integrated high school.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, let's go back to your time at Lincoln High, and then tomorrow or the next day
okay.
we can deal with other issues.
When we went to Lincoln, Mr. McDougall, Charles McDougall, came here in 1946 as a principal.